I'm sorry?
Testing.
It's on. Okay. Could everyone please take their seats? We're ready to start this part of the program. What?
Just for me to set up the microphone.
What? Okay. 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 That's water for you. Oh, you have your book. Okay.
Don't wait for the crowd.
No, I just brought it.
Don't wait for the crowd. Go.
It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. David Berger. Many of you might be here because of his recent books and the recent controversy. Well, a lot of it's just going to be plain academic approach to Messianism and the history of Messianism, but there'll be time for questions. Dr. David Berger is a professor of history at Brooklyn College and the Graduate Center of City University of New York, an immediate past president of the Association for Jewish Studies. He's also visiting professor of Jewish history at the Bernard Revel Graduate School of Yeshiva University, a fellow of the American Academy for Jewish Research, chair of the American Section of the International Association of Societies for the Study of Jewish History. All this is to give you a chance to sit down. And vice chair of the Academic Advisory Committee of the National Foundation for Jewish Culture. He is the author of The Jewish Christian Debate in the High Middle Ages, which was awarded the John Nicholas Brown Prize by the Medieval Academy of America, and co-author of Judaism's Encounter with Other Cultures, Rejection or Immigration, a finalist for the Jewish Book Award in Jewish Thought. His most recent book is The Rebbe, the Messiah, and the Scandal of Orthodox Indifference. He has written numerous studies on medieval Jewish history, Jewish-Christian relations, anti-Semitism, and the intellectual history of the Jews. It is my pleasure to introduce Dr. David Berger.
So let's make sure that everybody can hear. Is any? Yeah. Okay. A relative of mine who sometimes speaks in public says that he once asked if he could be heard in the back, and someone in the back said no, and someone in the front got up and said, "Can I change places with you?" Anyway, I will try to cover Jewish messianism from the beginning to the end in an hour or so. I will discuss the controversial subject that was alluded to in the last part of the discussion. The messianic faith of Judaism is one of the most important beliefs in the history of the world, by any standard. All that one has to say is that it produced Christianity. And that affirmation is established. But, of course, Jews ought to be interested in the messianic faith of Judaism for Jewish rather than Christian reasons. Though the rise of Christianity, as we shall see, has great relevance, unfortunately, to the evaluation of certain recent trends. I tried to capture the content of the traditional faith of Judaism in a single sentence in this book. This is a sentence that has nothing to do with the controversial issue that I addressed. It was simply an effort to define the content of the messianic faith of Judaism in its uncontroversial form, elements that all traditional Jews would accept. And here is the sentence. A king from the house of David will arise, who will preside over a peaceful, prosperous, monotheistic world, with the temple rebuilt and the Jewish people, including at some point its resurrected dead, returned to its land, period. Those are not trivial assertions. But they left Jews wanting to know more, much more. The belief that we will be redeemed from Archie Bunker called, speaking to God, this rotten world of yours, is a... He then apologized and said, "You did the best you could in 6 days." But the belief that that redemption would come obviously generated a desire to know more about the details of the end of days and about the time when the end of days would in fact come. I'm going to have to be selective as to the themes that I address here. And so let me begin by saying, just very briefly and then leaving that topic, that the classical rabbinic, that is, in the time of Chazal, the classical rabbinic vision of the end of days is one that perceives two stages of the redemptive process, the first of which is called the days of the Messiah, and the second of which is called the world to come. We are used to understanding the phrase the world to come, Olam Haba, under the influence of the Rambam, as a reference to the disembodied survival of the soul. But in rabbinic texts, that is in Chazal, there is very powerful evidence marshaled by the Ramban in his Shaar HaGmul, that this term referred to a second stage of the redemptive world, of the redeemed world, where there would be deep changes in nature. During the Messianic age proper, the question of natural change was a matter of dispute among Jewish authorities. The Rambam famously argued that the natural order would not change, making reference to a rabbinic statement by Shmuel that the difference between this world and the Messianic age is nothing more than the elimination of political oppression. No one actually thought that that's absolutely all the difference, but this is a formulation of what people usually call a naturalistic perception of the end of days. Where resurrection of the dead fits into this process was also a matter of some dispute, and one that I will not address here. The one very interesting question in describing the process of the end of days was when it would happen. Was there a way to know when redemption would come about? Now, there is a very important rabbinic assertion that speaks about two options for the time of redemption. One, that it will come, well, there's a verse in Isaiah which says, "I, the Lord, will hasten it in its time. Ani Hashem bi'itah achishena." And the rabbis understood the phrase, "I will hasten it in its time," as something of a self-contradiction. Either I will hasten it or it will come in its time. Which is it? And so they said, "Zachu achishena, if they merit it, then I will hasten it. Lo zachu, if they do not merit it, v'ita, it will come in its time. But it's guaranteed to come at a particular time." There is a very distinguished professor who got a chair at Columbia in a field of Jewish literature. There was a dinner honoring his appointment, and he gave a lecture on that occasion, which began at 8:30 p.m., and said he would discuss four themes in Agno. At 10 to 10, an hour and 20 minutes later, he said what people who were listening knew, and that is that he was just completing the third theme. So he turns to the chair of the evening and he said, "Well, I finished my third theme in Agnon. It's 10 to 10. You know, I've been speaking for an hour and 20 minutes. When do we have to end? And the chair, who was nobody's fool, said, we have to vacate the room in 10 minutes. At which point, instead of saying, well, I guess I have to stop, he said, well, I will do the best that I can in the remaining 10 minutes. I was sitting next to somebody, to a professor at NYU, who would know this rabbinic phrase, and I just wrote him a note saying, Lo zachu v'ita. If they don't merit it, it comes in its time. You know, it doesn't get hastened. Now, assuming that there is a final end, and this is what Jews assumed, the question was, is there a way to know what that end is? There are conflicting views in Chazal, in the Talmud, regarding the propriety of messianic calculation. There are a number of statements that strongly discourage such calculation, of which the most famous and perhaps the sharpest is usually translated, blasted be those who calculate the end. Tipach atzmon, sometimes quoted as tipach ruchon, shel mechashvei kitzin. However, on the same page that where we find this curse, we also find a number of messianic calculations made by the rabbis themselves. And this anomaly, as it were, on the same Talmudic page, Sanhedrin 97b, really reflects the tension over this issue throughout much of Jewish history. The rabbis, by the way, say why people who calculate the end should be blasted. And the reason is that if the date that they predicted passes and the Messiah does not come, then people might lose their faith that he will come at all. And so the refraining from calculation is the requirement to refrain, is there in order to prevent people from losing faith in the wake of miscalculation. I will return to this issue of calculation and how later Jews tried to maneuver around this rabbinic prohibition presently. But first let me say something about actual messianic movements or figures. Going back to rabbinic times, needless to say, the most influential Jewish messianic figure of then and of all time was a man named Jesus of Nazareth, whom I will not discuss here, since the movement that he started, of course, rapidly developed into a non-Jewish movement. But it's a matter of no small importance to note that this is, in fact, a Jewish messianic movement in its initial stage. Whether Jesus himself said he was the Messiah or not is a matter about which all sorts of ink has been spilled, and I won't address it here. The next important Jewish messianic figure was Bar Kokhba. Approximately a century after Jesus, the Jews revolted against Rome in the 130s, and the leader of this revolt was a man named Simon ben Kosiba, known as Bar Kokhba, which means son of a star, because Rabbi Akiva, the greatest rabbi arguably of the time, had said of him that the verse Darach Kochav Miyakov, a star will step forth from Jacob, understood messianically, referred to him. Now, the Bar Kokhba revolt was remarkably successful initially, considering the imbalance of power between the Roman Empire and the Jews. This is a revolt that was startlingly successful. It lasted for over 2 years, and initially the Romans were expelled from Judea. But of course it ultimately failed. and the messiahship of Bar Kokhba was not just rejected, but it became a dead letter, an issue that we will have to return to, not with respect to Bar Kokhba himself, but with respect to the general question of what the death of a messianic figure means in Judaism. When you get to the Middle Ages proper, you have a funny situation. We can cite about 20 or so messianic figures in medieval Jewish history, a little more even. But it's not clear that many of them, or even perhaps any of them, before the 16th century, deserve to be called real messianic movements. We should have standards when we say the term messianic movement. A number of these people claimed just to be forerunners of the Messiah. But even those who claimed to be the Messiah didn't establish followings of large numbers of people that lasted. We know the names of some of these people in part because Maimonides cites their names, in part because we have some brief notices in a variety of other sources. But I would be very hesitant to say that there were 20 or two dozen real messianic movements in medieval Jewish history. I would be more comfortable saying there were none than saying there were 24. I don't want to completely dismiss this. There were such figures, there was such activism, but it didn't amount to a lot. In the 16th century, there is a movement that deserves some serious attention. A fellow named Asher Lemlein in the early 16th century, not that we know much about him. This gives way to one of the most mysterious figures in Jewish history, a fellow who called himself David from the tribe of Reuven, who claimed to have come from God knows where there was a Jewish kingdom, where his brother was the king. He was going to hook up with the Christian monarchs of Europe to capture the land of Israel from the Muslims, and he actually got an audience with the Pope and an audience with a variety of major monarchs. What he would have done if they would have said, okay, you have a deal, I don't know. And for that matter, nobody really knows, even with any degree of confidence, even where he claims to come from, let alone where he actually came from. This takes the story, obviously, with a great deal of, I'd say, compression, through the 16th century in terms of movements. When we get to the 17th century, we'll have a movement we can talk about. But I would like to return at this point, once we've gotten to the end of the 16th century, to the question of messianic calculations. I said that Jews did their best, understandably, to try to get around the rabbinic curse against calculating. Jews wanted to know when the Messiah would come. I mean, it'd be abnormal not to want to know. The rabbi said you shouldn't try to figure it out. All right, so let's see what we can do to get around this prohibition. And there were a variety of ways to do that. One was simply to say that the prohibition was meant for the time of the rabbis because they knew that the end of days was very far off. And they didn't want people to calculate because people would get discouraged. But now that the redemption is clearly closer, it's okay. There is a story that is told by the 19th century biblical commentator Malbim, who makes this point in his commentary on Daniel, where he says that when he was a boy, he took a wagon ride with his father to a city around 2 weeks away by wagon. And after about an hour, he asked the wagon driver when they would arrive, at which point his father slapped him in the face. 2 weeks later, his father asked the same question. And he asked his father, why is it that when I ask this question, you slap me in the face, and now you're asking the same question? And the answer, of course, is that it depends when you ask. But the most brilliant way around this rabbinic prohibition is in a single line in the Ramban's Sefer HaGe'ulah, Book of the Redemption. If I understand correctly, This is what the Ramban says, and this is really, I mean, Ramban is one of the great Jews of all time, and this is worthy of him. This is what he said. Why did the rabbis say that we should not calculate the end of days? They tell us why. They tell us that we shouldn't calculate the end of days, because if we give a date, and the date passes, and the Messiah doesn't come, people will lose their faith. Right? They say why. Now, this is very nice, says the Ramban, as long as nobody has produced a date yet. But what happens? The Ramban is writing in the 1260s. He says, what happens if somebody has already produced a messianic date for 1290? He doesn't give these numbers, but we know of such a date for 1290. This is in the Ramban, this is one sentence. There are people who have said that the Messiah will come in the year 1290. I think that that's wrong. Right? I have a different date, which is later. Is this better? I think that that 1290 is wrong. I think that 1403 is right. So what's going to happen if I keep quiet? I won't say anything. The year 1290 will come. The year 1290 will pass. The Messiah won't be here. And people will lose their faith that the Messiah will come. Exactly what the rabbis were worried about. Exactly what they were worried about. What will happen if I do express my view and say that the correct date is 1403? The year 1290 will come. The Messiah presumably will not or might not come. So what will people say? People will say the Ramban's date is correct, and they will not lose faith. In other words, what he has done is taken the rabbinic prohibition or curse against calculating and turned it completely on its head, so that it almost becomes a requirement to calculate. Because if he's quiet, then what Chazal worried about will happen, and if he does calculate, what Chazal worried about will be prevented. Right? So the fact is that Jews calculate. Now, I want to give you one example of how these calculations worked, so you'll get some sense of how seductive an enterprise this is, how irresistible it is. So I'll give you my favorite calculation. Of all Jewish messianic calculations, this is my favorite. It didn't work out, but this is my favorite. At the end of the book of Daniel, it says that after a certain event, not a good event, it seems to say anyway, you should wait 1,335 days, which all Jews by the Middle Ages understood to mean years. All right? You should wait 1,335 years. So the question is only, simple number. It's an explicit number, if days means years. Which probably it doesn't. But if days means years, it's an explicit number, right? So all you have to know is when you start counting. If you know when you start counting, then you know when the Messiah will come. Now, the Ramban thought that you start counting with the destruction of the Second Temple, which he dated in the year 68 rather than the year 70 that we would give. So, you start with the year 68, CE, and you add 1,335 years, you wait 1,335 years, and you get to 1403. That's how he got that number. When that year passed, so Abarbanel, one of the great Jews of late medieval Spain, added 100 years to that number through a kind of maneuver that I don't have time to discuss. So you get 1503. and 1503 passed. What do you do now? Well, you have to start looking for a different starting point. Now, there happens to be a rabbinic statement that says that the world will last 6,000 years, and the last 2,000 are the period of the Messiah, but because of our sins, some of those years have already passed. In other words, the first year that the Messiah might come, potential coming, is the first year of the last 2,000 years. In other words, 4001. That's the first year the Messiah might come. Well, if the angel told Daniel to wait 1,335 years, it makes sense that he was telling him to wait from the point where waiting is reasonable, when you can expect the Messiah to come. And so, if you start the wait in the year 4001, and you get up to 1335, you're at 5,335 of the Jewish calendar, which equals the Christian date 1575. Now, so this wouldn't be enough for me to say this is my favorite calculation. What this is so far is a perfectly reasonable calculation given the genre that we're working with. This is straightforward. This makes a lot of sense. And then somebody noticed something unbelievable. You all know that Hebrew letters have numerical value, and therefore Hebrew words have numerical value. And people try to calculate the end of days, even before this, using gematriaot, using various forms of numerical calculations of this kind. Well, the number 1335 is found at the very end of the book of Daniel. So let me recite to you the last two verses of the book of Daniel, first in English and then in Hebrew. Happy is he who waits and reaches 1,335 days equals years. And now go to the end and relax, and you will rise up to your destiny at the end of days. That is the end of the book of Daniel, the last two verses in their entirety. Ashrei hamechakeh v'yagia liyomim 1,335. Ve'ata leich laketz v'sanuach v'sa'amol v'gorolcha leketz hayomi. Now, would somebody like to tell me what the numerical value of those two verses in their entirety is? What? All right. What is it? Well, what do you think it probably is? Well, 1335 wouldn't tell me anything because that number is explicit in the verse. I need to know what it means. So, it's not 1,335, it's 5,335. It's exactly 5,335. Now, how it is that any Jew, this was discovered by some Italian Jews in the 16th century, how it is that any Jew who read this did not believe it is beyond me. Because you had a perfectly reasonable argument for saying that would be the date, and then out of nowhere, you have this incredible gematria. And so, my purpose again is to demonstrate the seductiveness of this enterprise, but indirectly also to say something about how the 16th century is a period in which messianic expectations grow. And the 17th century produces by far the most successful messianic movement in all of Jewish history since Christianity. And Christianity, of course, ceases to be a Jewish movement rapidly. And so you could argue that this is the most successful messianic movement in Jewish history, at least until very recent years. In 1626, a fellow named Chabtai Tzvi was born in the Turkish city of Izmir, now Smyrna. At some point, In his early 20s, he started to do peculiar things. And the phrase peculiar or strange things, strange acts, ma'asim zarim, is the term that was used by his own followers later. He, according to one report, told the sun to stop moving the way Joshua had. Joshua, you will remember, brought the Jews into the land of Israel, so there's a messianic significance there. He is said to have pronounced the name of God that one is not supposed to pronounce. He was kicked out of Izmir and started wandering around the Ottoman Empire. During the next 10 years or so, from roughly 1648 to 1658, he periodically did a series of other strange things, including dressing a fish up in some sort of clothing and putting it in a crib, because the redemption of Israel will be, according to one rabbinic statement, under the constellation of Pisces, which is a fish. He is reported to have observed all three of the major festivals of the Shalosh Regalim in 1 week, presumably eating matzah and sitting in a sukkah, and I guess sitting up all night and learning, or if you prefer, maybe eating blintzes, all in 1 week. Which is an act that is a problem regarding that's a violation of Jewish law. The worst violation of Jewish law that he is reported to have committed was to have eaten chelev, which is a form of forbidden fat, and pronounced a brocha, Baruch Ata Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam, not matir asurim, one who looses the bound, but matir isurim, one who permits the forbidden. Now Gershom Scholem, who wrote the standard history of Shabtai Tzvi, although there's been much written since his great book, argued that Shabtai Tzvi suffered from manic depression, and that these acts took place in the manic phase of the illness. I once had a student who wrote on an exam, Shabtai Tzvi wasn't feeling well, and so he went to his doctor, Gershom Scholem, who told him he was a manic depressive. It happens also, by the way, that this is a family story, that when I was engaged to my wife, her then 4-year-old sister, my wife is the oldest of 5 siblings, the youngest one was then 4, wanted me to tell her stories about Jewish history, which she called storias. So what could I do? I wanted to marry her sister, so I had to do it. So I told her about Shabtai Tzvi, among others. 3 years later, my wife's sister was engaged to someone else who had to tell her stories about Jewish history, this time to the 7-year-old little sister. But he needed to know whether I had already told her this story. And so he asked her whether I had told her about Shabtai Tzvi, and she said, "Oh, you mean the manic depressive." This is a true story. The truth is, when you think about it, why should she know that that's a word she's not supposed to know? It's another word. Anyway, but she remembered. In 1665, Shabtai Tzvi was in Israel, in Jerusalem, and made the acquaintance of a brilliant young prodigy named Nathan of Gaza, who claims to have a prophetic revelation that Shabtai Tzvi was the Messiah. Shabtai Tzvi had messianic delusions already in 1648, briefly, but didn't advertise them much. This combination of Nathan of Gaza, who came to be known as Nathan the Prophet, there is a biblical prophet called Nathan the Prophet, and Shabtai Tzvi produced an unprecedented, remarkable messianic movement. The only messianic movement in all of Jewish history in which a majority of the Jewish people, probably a substantial majority of the Jewish people, believed that this man was the Messiah for a period of a few months. This never happened before and has not happened since, that a majority of the world Jewish population believed that this man is the Messiah. Maybe that was true of Bar Kokhba, but I'm not sure of that. Uh, Eventually, Shabtai Tzvi was imprisoned. When the Muslim authorities became upset by this excitement, but even in his prison, he was allowed to receive visitors and treated it as a kind of royal palace. Finally, in one of the strangest scenes, one that is masterfully portrayed or painted by Sholem in his book, a peculiar Jew from Poland named Nechemia Cohen came to see Shabtai Tzvi, supposedly representing a few Polish communities, to determine what he thought about Shabtai Tzvi's claims. And Cohen argued that certain things that were supposed to have been fulfilled already according to rabbinic texts, especially the coming of a pre-messianic figure called Messiah son of Joseph, before Messiah son of David comes, hadn't happened. And therefore this man cannot be the Messiah. So how could he be the Messiah, Messiah son of David, when Messiah son of Joseph hadn't come yet? And you have a debate for 3 years in a prison between a man claiming to be Messiah son of David and a Polish Jew in the presence of the aides of the Messiah, arguing rabbinic and Kabbalistic texts to determine whether this man really is the Messiah. Cohen was sufficiently upset that he went to the Muslim authorities, but first converted to Islam to gain credibility, and told them that this is a very dangerous man, and Shabtai Tzvi was forced to confront the choice of conversion to Islam or death, and in September of 1666, he chose conversion. And so the Messiah, son of David, became a Muslim. Now this was a shock of such monumental proportions that the majority of world Jewry, difficult as it was, recognized that this had been a terrible mistake. Others, however, continued to believe and constructed a theology, a complex and fascinating theology, no less brilliant than its Christian counterpart, to explain why Messiah, son of David, would die, would indeed convert, and then die before the redemption would come. And the argument was that, and I can't go into the details here at all, but there was a mystical system that spoke about how the evil world in which we live has sparks of holiness trapped in it, and the way to bring redemption is to bring the final sparks of holiness out of this world of evil and raise them back up to the upper worlds. When that happens, the world of evil will lose its source of sustenance and will cease to exist. The Sabbatean believers after the apostasy argued that it is the job of the Messiah to get out those last trapped sparks of holiness. And they are so deeply embedded in the world of evil that they cannot be removed from the outside. And therefore the Messiah has to enter the world of evil in order to get them out. And so we have a theology justifying not a crucified Messiah, which was difficult enough, but an apostate Messiah, a Messiah who is a Meshumad, arguably the worst word in the medieval and modern Jewish lexicon. Believers in Shabtai Tzvi, though a small minority of the world Jewish population, persisted through the end of the 18th century on a level that is significant for Jewish history, though we cannot pursue it. On a certain level, Messianic activism was discouraged by the Sabbatean fiasco. Jews were more and more hesitant, more and more gun-shy about messianic claims in the wake of this disaster. And you do not really have a significant, there are exceptions, you do not have a significant messianic movement in the 18th and 19th centuries outside of the remnants of Sabbatianism. In the 20th century, two fascinating things happen. First, there is a movement called Zionism, which produces a sub-movement called religious Zionism, which does contain a powerful messianic component in some of its forms. Not all of its forms. The founder of Mizrahi, Rabbi Reines, was not a messianic religious Zionist. Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer, his predecessor as a kind of proto-Zionist, was. Rav Kook was. Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook was all the more. And religious Zionism is a different kind of messianism in that it is a genuine messianic movement in one sense, but it is without a messianic figure, which makes it very atypical and gives it the advantage of being able to survive beyond a single generation. And then there is the remarkable and really fascinating phenomenon of Lubavitch messianism. The Lubavitch movement began to develop a messianic character already in the last days of the fifth Rebbe, but this came primarily to some degree of public attention after, in the last years, well, during the years of the Holocaust and shortly thereafter, when the sixth Rebbe began to actually publish assertions that the redemption in the context and in the wake of the Holocaust was absolutely imminent. When he died, when the sixth Rebbe died, he was succeeded after a hiatus of a year in 1951 by the most recent Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson. In the very first formal discourse that he delivered after he formally became Rebbe, he declared that the seventh generation of Lubavitch Rebbes, that is, his own generation, was definitely the generation of the redemption, using terminology that he took from his father-in-law. He was not the son of the sixth Rebbe, but his son-in-law. He spoke about how the final steps of this invisible redemptive process in which good and evil are separated on a cosmic level has been completed. That process is over. It's done. And the Messiah is already here, and it's only necessary to greet him. These were assertions made through the career of the most recent Rebbe, but most vigorously and most openly in the 1980s. And until his first stroke in the early 1990s. These were unequivocal assertions that the redemption is imminent, that the prince of the generation is the... essentially, he spoke about it being his deceased father-in-law, but he was understood by his Hasidim to be referring at least also to himself because of the belief that they shared the same soul. The Rebbe, for example, and this is something that tends to strike people hard if they don't know it, the Rebbe, in one of his discourses in the 1980s, declared that the third and final temple, which according to Rashi will not be built by human hands but will come down from fully built from heaven, the Rambam disagreed with that, but that was Rashi's position, that it would descend not in Jerusalem, but would initially descend in Crown Heights, next to 770 Eastern Parkway, and the two buildings would then be transferred to Jerusalem. In short, there was a very, very powerful message that gave the Hasidim an overwhelming impression, reasonably and understandably, that the Rebbe is the Messiah. Now, he also discouraged, until the, near the very end, public affirmations that he was the Messiah, and even discouraged this vigorously. But he did say all the things that I just cited. And so the Hasidim were convinced that he would not die, he would bring the redemption. Even after his stroke, they were convinced that he would not die, but would bring the redemption. And after his death, the question became, what does one do? I've already indicated, and I will not discuss here the debates about texts, I've already indicated that throughout Jewish history, the death of a messianic figure was decisive evidence in the eyes of mainstream Jewry that this man is not the Messiah. The Rambam says that, this as explicitly as a human being can possibly say anything. Certainly, there is no Jewish text that envisions the possibility that God will send the true Messiah to announce that the redemption is here virtually, that it has virtually begun, and say the other things that the Rebbe said, and then die in an unredeemed world. Whatever texts are cited to show the remote possibility that the Messiah could come from the dead do not cover such an option. However, because of the depth and intensity of this belief, it has persisted. It remains, without any question, the belief of a substantial majority of the Babich Hasidim, despite whatever assertions you hear to the contrary. I don't have time now to demonstrate this. If you like, you can look at the discussion in chapter 12 of my book. There is simply no question about this. Anybody who thinks, as many do, that this is a belief that will disappear if ignored, should listen to the following song. I don't know the tune. This comes from the songbook of the main girls' high school in Crown Heights, called Beis Rivka, from a songbook of last year that was distributed in the Homolak Hotel during a Shabbaton. This is not quite a year ago, actually. I have to say that I have difficulty reading this without being deeply affected. I mean, I actually have had tears in my eyes when I read this, despite my alleged hatred of Lubavitch. It is very difficult to read this on a human level without being deeply disturbed and moved. But it's also very difficult to read this and then assume that this belief is going to die with the next generation. Let me read this to you. At Har Sinai, the Yidden did stand. There are a few Hebrew Yiddish expressions here. I'm not going to bother translating them. I think it's sort of going to lose the effect, and it won't matter in terms of understanding the point. At Har Sinai, the Yidden did stand. Vayichan Shom Yisrael, hand in hand. Moshe, their Rebbe, told them he must leave in order that the Torah they may receive. For 40 days I will be gone. Do not despair, you must remain strong. My dear children, I will return, and Hashem's Torah we will learn. With great anticipation, they counted each day, but the time was passing. How much longer must they wait? Where is our Rebbe? The Yidden did cry. 40 days gone by, we need you at our side. The Satan pointed to the sky. This refers to a midrash that Satan showed the Jews the apparent coffin of Moses. And this is what made them give up and build the golden calf. The Satan pointed to the sky. Look up at your leader. See, he died. A bed they saw. The pain they could not take. This led them to make the fateful mistake. In 770, we all did hear the Rebbe King Moshiach stating clear, Anovim, the time of your redemption is here. For Moshiach you must prepare. Although it may be hard, we do not see. I know that the Rebbe is looking after me and is asking you and me, what have you done to bring the Geula and Moshiach, our King? With great anticipation, we count each day, but time is passing. How much longer must we wait? Where is our Rebbe? We all do cry. It's taking much too long. We need you on our side. The Satan says, no reason to believe. Look at your Mashiach. He did leave. But no. This time our emuna you cannot shake. We will not make the same fateful mistake. Signs of redemption the Rebbe made us see. The world watches on as it changes dramatically. Victory in the Gulf War, the Russian Jews are freed, weaponry dismantled, replaced by things of need. The Golus night is passing, the sun's about to rise. All we have to do is open up our eyes to feel the Rebbe's message, to hear the Rebbe's plea. Omer al Hagag, sitting on the roof, that's a phrase in a sicha of the Rebbe, to proclaim for all to see, Anovim, Anovim, Higia Hazman, the time has come. I'm going to skip a little, even though it's a shame to skip any of this. Rebbe, Rebbe, mein teure Tate, this letter I write to you, my emotions deep within me, I can only turn to you. I hear them speak of verbringens, of hours spent together, your hands constantly giving and a smile of love and care. But Rebbe, I'm so young, my memories are so vague. All I have are the dollars that you gave. How will I grow to be what the Rebbe wants of me? Father, please tell me how my life I should lead. Mein Kind, don't worry, I'm here with you. Learning my Torah makes it clear to you. The world is ready, the time is near. Spreading my Torah brings Geula here. Redemption has arrived. That's what the Rebbe prophesied. Mashiach has come. It's already begun. Let's rejoice in ecstasy because we're sure as can be that tekef umiyad, immediately, our very eyes will see the Rebbe King Mashiach walking right into shul, smiling at his kinderlach, cheering on their song. The world will gather passionately to the Rebbe in 770 in the Beis HaMikdosh HaShlishi, the third temple. We know it won't be long. Why has so much time gone by? This question brings tears to our eyes. Rebbe, dear Rebbe, we know you are alive. But why can't we see you? Why all the suffering? Yet we believe in you with perfect faith. Soon we know we'll see. This generation is not going to stop believing that the Rebbe is the Mashiach, because we think that this is a non-rational belief, assuming we do. Let me say a few more things. Lubavitch is not a marginal movement. Lubavitch is the dominant form of Orthodox Judaism in many, many places worldwide. Certainly so in peripheral areas, but to a growing extent in major or relatively major Jewish centers, in Italy, in Australia, even in England, in France, in Argentina, in Brazil, and in many other places. The notion that this is a marginal movement is just simply false. Given the fact that this is a movement whose large majority believes the Rebbe is the Messiah, and the fact that mainstream Orthodox Judaism has accepted the Orthodox legitimacy of rabbis who openly proclaim that the Rebbe is the Messiah, it follows, in my view, ineluctably, unavoidably, that the Jewish religion's messianic faith has been transformed fundamentally, so that it is now acceptable within Orthodox Judaism to affirm that God, in fact, has sent the true Messiah to proclaim the redemption and then die in an unredeemed world. This is a position that is unheard of in taking into account all the texts that Chabad people cite. This position, as I formulated it, is unheard of in any previous Jewish text. It is denied vigorously and vehemently in text after text, especially polemical texts against Christianity, but also others, as a fundamental defining characteristic of the messianic faith of Judaism, which, according to the Rambam and most Jews, is one of most Orthodox Jews, is one of the Ikarei HaEmunah, one of the fundamental elements of Jewish belief. And I now come to something that is even more disturbing, if that is possible. And this people will find so difficult to accept that I know that unless you read the book and unless you look at some of those passages carefully and with an open mind, you will simply not want to absorb that this can be so. But it is. And that's the question of the divinity of the Rebbe. Now, the Rebbe used a formula which I do not regard as necessarily Avodah Zarah, foreign worship, even though some of his, Rav Shach thought it was. I do not say it was. I think it's a mistake to cite this and this alone. But he said that a Rebbe of the highest order is the essence and being of God in a body. Now that can be interpreted non-literally. And in fact, in the context in which he says it, he says that just as the Rebbe is the essence and being, the Atzmus u'Mahus in a body, so the Chosid is one with the Rebbe. And obviously it doesn't mean that the Chosid has all the knowledge of the Rebbe and all the ability of the Rebbe. So this statement in and of itself can be understood, and I think should be understood, in a fashion weaker than what it sounds like at first glance. However, there are many, not one or two or three, there are many Lubavitch Hasidim in important positions in the movement who believe the following literally. We begin with the assertion that the Rebbe is the essence and being of a God and a body. How is this so? Well, a supremely righteous man annuls his essence to that of God to the point where his own essence ceases to exist. So far, these are metaphors found in some Hasidic writings. Consequently, his entire essence becomes divinity. So then you ask, do you really mean this literally? And a significant number of people at the heart of the movement who don't say the words the Rebbe is God and get upset if you say those words, because it has other, those words in their view have implications that they don't believe. But nonetheless, they say the following. Because the Rebbe is the essence and being of God in a body, because his entire essence is divinity, he is all-knowing, he is all-powerful, he is without any limits, he is incapable on principle of sin. His body could not even have died on some level because only limited things die, and the Rebbe is without limits. Even that, at least on principle, it would be permissible to bow to him with the understanding that he is nothing but divinity. These are not marginal assertions in Chabad. They are not marginal assertions. I don't say that this large majority or even a majority would say what I just said without qualification, but I do say that a significant number of Lubavitch Hasidim, not just the few people who say the words that the Rebbe is actually God, believe this. In other words, and people who have said this and written this are treated as Orthodox rabbis in good standing. The institutions where they teach are supported by mainstream Orthodoxy. And that means that we now have a religion, at least as an organized religion, in which it is permissible to say that God sent Messiah, son of David, to announce the redemption, that he then died or appeared to die in an unredeemed world, that this man was or is the pure essence of God, that he is omniscient, omnipotent, unbounded, incapable of sin, and that it is possible on principle or permissible on principle to bow to him. And this person who says all of these things can be treated and is treated as an Orthodox rabbi. His shechita is accepted. He can be a dayan in a rabbinic court that's not a Lubavitch rabbinic court. He can be a sofer, and people will use his mezuzahs in Sifrei Torah, and on and on. From my perspective, the power of the Messianic faith of Judaism has in the last several years, in a generation with no Orthodox leadership to speak of, transformed, undermined the Jewish religion at its core, so that, at least as an organized phenomenon, as an organized belief system, we no longer have a religion.
Okay, you take your question.
You said that no messianic movement within Judaism has survived the death of Messiah. Didn't the Sabbatean movement?
Sure did. I said that. Excuse me. That it did not survive as a part of as a recognized part of the mainstream. Of course, the Sabbatean movement did. As I said, the Sabbatean movement survived with remarkable vigor, although as a minority movement, a small minority, but not an insignificant one, for over 100 years. And there are historians who believe that there were significant rabbis who actually believed this after Shabtai Tzvi's conversion and death. However, the difference, and it's a crucial difference, there have been people who've said to me on more than one occasion, including on public forums, that after all, there are many historians who believe that Rav Yonasan Eibeshitz was a Sabbatian, and yet everybody accepts him as a rabbinic authority. To which my answer is that irrespective of what one thinks about the historical question, the only reason why Rav Yonasan Eibeshitz is accepted as a rabbinic authority is that the assumption, the consensus of the Jewish collective was that the suspicions of his Sabbateanism were false. Had Jews, mainstream Jews, believed that those affirmations were true, then he would not have been regarded as a rabbinic authority. So the point is a point of legitimation, not of survival. It's of survival as a legitimate manifestation within the mainstream. And that never happened.
But that was 100 years later, Yonasan Eibeshitz. In the first 20 years or so?
I am not aware of any rabbi who affirmed that Shabtai Tzvi was the Messiah after his apostasy. Remember, he didn't only die. I mean, he converted to Islam. I am not aware of any rabbi who affirmed that Shabtai Tzvi was the Messiah after his apostasy openly, who was recognized by the mainstream Jewish community as an authentic, legitimate rabbinic leader.
According to Lubavitch movement, then, who was Mashiach ben Yosef? Because that is a very strong belief in the messianic progression.
Okay, that's a very interesting question. There is one Lubavitch rabbi in the world that I know who lives in this city who actually thinks that the Rebbe may have been Mashiach ben Yosef. But the important answer, I mean, it's a very important question and a very interesting one. There are a variety of strategies to deal with this problem. The most interesting one goes like this. In the 19th century, maybe even earlier, but I'm not so sure there's anything like that real earlier, but by the 19th century, there were Jews who were saying that Mashiach ben Yosef, who is this warrior Messiah who comes before the real Messiah, may not have to die. It may be possible that there could be a Mashiach ben Yosef who doesn't actually die. Moreover, this kind of led to the notion that it's possible that Mashiach ben Yosef and Mashiach ben David will turn out to be the same person, even though Mashiach ben Yosef, it sounds, has to come from a different lineage. But Mashiach ben Yosef is a metaphor. It means that he will be a warrior Messiah like Joseph, who is in some metaphorical sense a warrior. And consequently, there are Lubavitch Hasidim who say that the Lubavitch Rebbe, the most recent Lubavitch Rebbe, was both Mashiach ben Yosef, had his stroke, died, or looked like he died, and is also Mashiach ben David. Another option, although they don't usually choose this option, is to take the bull by the horns and adopt the explicit view of Rav Saadia Gaon, that Mashiach ben Yosef is optional. Under the right scenario, he doesn't have to come. If the redemption comes without war, then he doesn't have to show up. And the truth is that Maimonides never mentions him. I'm not asking you to like those answers. I don't like those answers particularly. But that It's a very good question, and therefore the answers are dochak.
What is the essential? I'm sorry.
You have to decide.
Yeah, go right ahead.
What is the essential difference in the messianism of the Lubavitch movement and that of Reb Nachman of Breslov?
Reb Nachman of Breslov, with the exception of a few, I would say, flirtations very shortly after his death with the idea that he might be the Messiah, was regarded by his followers, those who thought that he was a Messiah of any sort, as Mashiach ben Yosef. There is a book by Arthur Green called Tormented Master about Rav Nachman of Breslov, arguing that is what he himself believed about himself. But Breslov Hasidism, while it has certain elements, certain theological elements that I must say I find troubling, does not affirm the messiahship in the sense of Mashiach ben David of Rav Nachman. The fact that redemption has not actually come in terms of universal peace is the very issue that makes Lubavitch messianism so anomalous in the history of Jewish messianism. That is, except for Christianity and Sabbatianism, Jews have uniformly rejected the notion that the Messiah could begin his career and die in an unredeemed world. That's exactly the point. That is precisely the point. Problems in the world today actually are problematic for some Lubavitch messianists because of the fact that the Rebbe had actually spoken about universal peace already breaking out. You noticed that if you paid close attention to that song, that peace was already breaking out. The Rebbe said such things in the early 90s with the breakdown of the Soviet Union and the victory in the Gulf War and so on. The problems that now exist are troubling from that perspective for Lubavitch messianists.
One more question.
I feel a responsibility is to challenge you to some extent, not so much on the content, but in the strategy. The Rav used to, or Schefter will quote in the Rav's name, that Havim Asunim Adin, when it says the beginning of Pirkei Avos, you have to be deliberate in judgment. Sometimes it takes 5, 10, 15, 20 years to think about an issue as to how to respond to it. So in the world, the Orthodox world, which has been a part of a hemorrhaging Jewish world for many years, the notion of the Orthodox world taking on part of itself in a fight is very disturbing. And I think that the reason why the Orthodox world has not challenged Lubavitch on some of the views is that we have enough trouble as, just holding on to our own and have enough trouble just maintaining ourselves in this difficult world, that silence and peace is a value that we want to maintain, and we don't want to challenge in a world, even if the beliefs are ones that we ought to challenge, we don't want to take on that fight in the world that we live in.
Sociologically, what you say is absolutely unimpeachably correct. That is one of many, unfortunately, many very powerful reasons for the silence. I wrote a whole chapter in the book called Explaining the Inexplicable, in which I... Which depressed me enormously, because I ended that chapter with the sense that I had provided so many powerful reasons in terms of sociology as to why this silence exists, that I considered the chances of overcoming this silence to be remote. And I do consider the chances remote. We have to understand, at least we have to understand, I believe, that what this silence means is acquiescence in this belief. As the Lubavitch movement gets stronger and stronger, as Jews, in my view, eat foods that they're not allowed to eat, and drink wine that they may not be allowed to drink, and use Sifrei Torah that causes them to say Brachos Levatola, and because of the Avodah Zarah part, which we certainly have no right to do. But even if we stick to the messianism, it's for this reason, for the reason of this consideration about waiting 5, 10, 20 years, the longer we wait, the less likely it is that anything will be accomplished. Because, first of all, it's hard to see what will trigger a sudden decision to act 20 years from now. Second, there will already be a substantial precedent of great rabbis, presumably, who decided to be silent. And then you have to overcome this sense that who are you to reverse their decision. You will have a movement that has spread further and further throughout the world to a position, as I said, and I don't consider this alarmist at all. This is a fact of dominance of Orthodox life, and in some cases virtually exclusive Orthodox life in many places in the world. So that I see delay as a recipe for surrender and the transformation of Judaism, the undermining of Judaism, on our watch. And that's what I think.
I'm sure there are many more questions. We have to break for mincha. I'd just like to thank Dr. Berger, and I'm sure he'll allow you to ask him questions privately.